Welcome to the Spoolcast. Nate Schuda joins Jared Spool in a discussion about prototyping for mobile. Nate will be presenting one of the day-long workshops at the UX Immersion Conference April 7th through 9th in Denver, Colorado. For more information, visit uxim.co. That's uxim.co. And now, here's Jared.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Spoolcast. This is Jared Spool, your host, and I am so pleased that today I am talking with Nate Schuda, who is an expert in teaching designers how to program in JavaScript and in jQuery, which is exactly the thing you need to do if you would want to create web-based prototypes. And in fact, he's going to be talking to us at the UX Immersion Conference in Denver on April 9th. He's going to be talking about coding prototypes, even if you haven't tried, by introducing you to both JavaScript and jQuery Mobile. Nate, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Great to be here.
So there's been this thing that I've gotten myself wedged into, which is, you know, I started as a developer. So for me, it seems straightforward. A lot of designers are scared of touching code. They think that the minute they learn how to program, they're going to be shipped off to some IT development farm.
Siberia,
yes, where they're going to be heads down in front of green screens writing code for the rest of their life that will only be used to take inventory of pig futures. But the fact is that programming is, A, you tell me, but I don't think it's that hard. I think it's easy for designers to learn, particularly the CSS part, which is really just a great design language. And then you get into JavaScript, which lets you manipulate that, and jQuery, which really makes it fun. I don't know. What do you think?
No, I think there's a lot of misconceptions, I think, about programming and how hard or easy it is. And I think you're right. I think there's a lot of folks who, for whatever reason, just sort of have it in their head that, well, I don't want to be a programmer. And I go back to when I got started in this industry, and you can see the shift just in kind of the personalities that are drawn to programming, you know, just sort of the approaches people take, you know. And I mean, I saw it just within my college career, that the difference between like the graduating class of CS majors when I was a freshman versus by the time I graduated is a very, very different type of person, group of people. And, you know, so I do think there's maybe a little bit of truth to that Siberia thing, though, because the demand for IT services has far outstripped supply since I think the first time someone showed a business person a spreadsheet and said, look what you can do. And ever since then, you know, we've been running at this deficit. But I think there's a lot of value in being able to bridge those two camps, though. You know, I've spent a lot of my career as a developer trying to be a design advocate when there were no design people around. And I think there's a lot of value in the design people being able to speak some of the programmer language. You know, it helps everybody, I think, collaborate better and work better together and gain some mutual respect there, and, you know, instead of just viewing one or the other as that strange person who does this thing I don't understand.
So you don't have to jump from knowing nothing about programming to being the world's best IT developer, right? There's this sort of middle ground. In fact, it's actually really useful if you just know a little bit of code. It's not one of these things where it's dangerous to know a little bit, is it?
Right. I don't think so. You know, and that's a good point. Nobody's born knowing how to program. You know, that's something I think some folks maybe think, that just because maybe some of us have been doing it for a very long time, you know, I mean, let's be honest, none of us were in first grade learning how to program, most likely, you know, so we all start somewhere and we all get better at it as we practice. The same with design. I mean, you don't start right out of the box being able to design really good interfaces either. You know, so no, I think there's a lot of value in at least understanding what's going on and understanding why some of these things that may seem really easy and straightforward on paper, when you show it to your developers, they sort of freak out and go, oh my God, there's no way we can build that. And, you know, you look at a designer and say, well, but this is so simple. And it's like, right, except for all these technology constraints that I have that make that really hard for me to actually implement. You know, so I think having a little bit of that knowledge can certainly help in that regard to appreciate, you know, the other side of the coin. And again, I think that's a two-way street. Like I say, I've long been on the developer side trying to convince developers to care about doing design and that it isn't a magical thing either.
And so let's talk for a second about getting developers to care about doing design. What's the real value to having that bridge crossed for them. I mean, I think that we start in this world where, we just give really detailed specs, then we're done, right?
Yeah. I mean, from my standpoint, it's understanding the importance of it and why it isn't just some subjective argument over a shade of blue, you know, that there are really good reasons to do these things. And I mean, one of the things that I've battled almost my entire career is you run into this thing where it's like, well, it's just one extra click, or it's just an extra 5 seconds or a minute or whatever. It's like, well, that's true, except when you start doing the math on that and you start to understand that, right, that's going to affect how many users, how many times a day, how many times a week, and you start doing that math, and then you kind of see their eyes start to open up a little bit. But it's getting people to understand that it isn't just this subjective, I like this better because it's prettier. There's science to it too, and I think that is a revelation, frankly, to some developers that think it's all just, you know, drawing pretty pictures and that there's a lot more to it than that.
So it's funny, right, that we know that there's a lot more to design than just the drawing pretty pictures thing. But then when the developers come to us and say, that's hard, we think, well, they just don't want to do it.
Right. Well, and let's be honest, sometimes that's true. You know, I mean, sometimes it's, I don't agree with you.
And sometimes design is just picking a color out of
your
butt.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I mean, hey, we've all been on that project where it's like, why is this purple? Oh, that's right. The VP's favorite color is purple. Okay. All right.
Maybe. Oh, no. My favorite one was, we can't use that shade of green because the CEO's ex-wife wore a sweater that was that shade of green and he never wants to see it again.
Wow. That's okay. All right. I can understand making that emotional connection, but that seems a very limiting thing to the palate. But okay. All right. I've worked with weird constraints before, but yeah, it is interesting, I think, how that works, where you need to appreciate both sides of that coin and understand that, you know, design is a lot more than just drawing pictures and development's a lot more than typing, you know. But I think a lot of those same mindsets that work for one help in the other. And I've long been a big believer that code is far more artistic in nature than it is scientific in nature. And I'm certainly a proponent that code can be beautiful, you know, maybe not to the average layperson, but, you know, I certainly can appreciate the craftsmanship that goes into it. And I just think having that appreciation is very helpful to folks, you know, when you're on a team together, especially if you're on an agile team, everybody's in the same room, you know, it really helps to understand that, okay, yeah, I thought what that guy did was really simple, but then I tried doing it for a few days and I realized that, yeah, there's a lot more to it than I first thought.
Yeah, so there's this mutual respect that comes out of understanding the craft, right? If I realize that you understand the effort it takes, it's easier for me to try a little harder. I mean, my favorite things are when I'm talking to developers and they go, yeah, we can't do that. And then the next day they come in, you know, I was thinking in the shower and there might be a way we could do that. And that sort of willingness to come part way because you've gone part way, I think really does make a difference. And you're like, yeah, okay, I get it. This is really hard. You're putting in some really, really difficult effort here. But I think there's also something that comes from this, from the design standpoint, in knowing your medium, right? If the design that you're creating has to be implemented through the tools, there are things the tools can do. There are things the tools can't do. There are things you can do easily. There are things they can't do easily. And you can get more done if you choose things that can be done easily every time. If you choose things that are hard, then it's going to take more time. It's going to take more effort to QA. So the costs are higher. It's going to mean you get to do less. And so understanding the medium, doesn't that give you some advantage there?
Oh, absolutely. You hear about these stories in like physical designs with like cars or, you know, water heaters, things like that, where, you know, the original design people aren't talking to manufacturing. And once manufacturing gets it, like, my God, this is going to be nearly impossible to make, or it's going to be really expensive because you're using all this material. Well, when those two groups start chatting with one another, it's like, oh, we didn't realize that it had that effect. We can tweak the design. You make a small change to the design, you get the same output, but all of a sudden it's easier to make, cheaper to make, less material, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And you end up having a much bigger win all the way around. You know, I know one of the appliance manufacturers ran into that where they brought a whole bunch of design and construction work back into the U.S. And that was what ended up happening. In order to make it work economically, they got everybody working together, you know, radically changed the design on this particular appliance, ended up making it far cheaper, far easier to build, you know, and more efficient all, you know, at the same time. It's like, that's a pretty big win when people are talking to one another. To me, that's the whole goal of so many of these approaches we're using in software today, whether it's Agile or Kanban or Lean or whatever you want to call it. It's all about getting us to talk to one another and get rid of these walls where you just pitch it over and, okay, I drew all the boxes. Now somebody's got to make those boxes real. And then they throw it over the wall to somebody who makes sure that the boxes do what they're supposed to do. This stuff works a lot better when we're talking with one another and bouncing ideas off of one another, you know, coming to an approach together as opposed to all being in our little silos.
Do you ever find yourself in your work, you know, granted you've been doing this for a long time, so you got a lot of skills, but do you ever find yourself sort of throwing together a quick idea, knowing that the code that you're making is never going to ever, ever possibly be the production code, but that doesn't matter because you just want to show somebody an idea?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's very common. I built a couple widgets last year with that exact thing in mind. It was not production code. It was just, okay, this is what you're asking for. Does this look right to you? Is this what you really had in mind? And here's the implications for what you're asking for. And are you okay with that? You know, and in at least one case that worked really well for them to say, ooh, well, now that I actually see it, I'm not so interested in it. You know, so to me, that's a huge part of it, is getting an understanding of, all right, how hard is this to actually build? What might this look like? And then to get a chance to really play with it. I'm a huge believer in paper prototyping and have been, you know, essentially my entire career. But I mean, let's be honest, you get to a certain point where it's like, you know, I really need to see what this feels like. What is this actually going to look like when it's rendered, you know, especially if we're talking touch interfaces these days, you know, is it going to work right or not? And there's really not a great way of doing that, at least from my experience, without getting that out there in some prototyping code.
Yeah. So when you're doing this and you're getting that feedback, right, the actual quality of the underlying code is really not the issue at the time then.
Right.
So it's okay if it's really sloppy. It's the whole point is just to get it on the table.
Right, right. You may evolve that code into more production-ready code, but you know, let's be honest, we've all done something quick and dirty just to get some feedback on it to see what it looks like. And you know, hopefully we don't just copy and paste that into our production app and leave it as is. There lies danger, but you know, again, just being able to conceive of that idea and see it as opposed to just, you know, drawing it and sort of looking at it in a flat world, you know, to me is a very powerful tool to have. And you know, getting back to that whole collaboration communication thing, and this is another part of that that can be so useful. I mean, you look at modern operating systems that have multi-swipe gesture type things built into it. You know, one of the things that they have to try to describe this to you, you know, what does it mean to do a three-finger drag? Well, here's a video of someone's hand going across the trackpad. That's a lot easier to get that idea conveyed than trying to describe that in words. So, you know, you can come up with this really elaborate design. Maybe you can get it down on paper, but sometimes the only way or the best way to communicate that with your developers, with your users is, hey, I'm going to code it up and I'm actually going to show you what I mean, as opposed to, well, you know, I want it to kind of look like this. You know, I want a little bit of this sort of fadey kind of looking thing. And then I want it to be this, you know, just code it up and then let's look at it. And again, it isn't that hard. I mean, especially with libraries like jQuery and jQuery Mobile and some of the things we have at our disposal today, it's gotten, you know, quite a bit easier, you know, than what it was back when, you know, the only thing we had in our toolbox was an alert statement. You know, so it isn't as unapproachable as I think some people have trained themselves or out of fear, you know, that, oh, I don't want to go near that because, you know, it sounds dangerous. You know, there's semicolons involved. It's okay. It's just typing, basically.
Yeah, so let's talk about this, right? So jQuery Mobile, this is a library of functions that basically let you do things in phone-based apps. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's basically take jQuery and what would it look like on a mobile device? You know, what kind of widgets would people want? What kind of page structure? It's lighter weight, obviously, since we care quite a bit about page weights in the mobile space these days. You know, and it's really, in my experience, very fast to get kind of up and running with. You know, there's not a whole lot of overhead. You can actually do an awful lot of things just in pure HTML without even having to dig down deep into, you know, raw JavaScript. I mean, eventually you're going to, obviously, on anything, you know, non-trivial, but you can get an awfully long way just playing with HTML, which for a lot of folks, that's more comfortable to them, even though, I mean, come on, it's still code. It's still a language, just different kind of language, but still same general ballpark, you know, so it's very approachable in my experience for a wide range of skill sets.
So if I wanted to start to work on, you know, what our app might look like with the navigation and putting in some sample content, maybe showing how it works with a couple of gestures, that's not rocket science here.
No, not at all. That's the kind of thing you can get up and running really, really quickly. I gave a talk a couple years ago on jQuery Mobile. It was just a 90-minute talk. And in the period of that 90-minute talk, I had a guy sitting in the front row who had an app up and running against live data, you know, in the 90 minutes it took me to describe this stuff to him. So in real time, basically, as I'm describing these concepts, he's sitting there with his laptop, you know, clickety-clacking away. And when we broke, he came up with his phone and showed me this thing running on his phone.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, that to me was pretty impressive that he was able to do that, you know. So it doesn't require years of learning at the feet of the masters, you know, in order to do that. You don't have to go become a monk or something before one can be approachable here. You know, you can do something quickly. You can get up to speed quickly and start producing, you know, stuff pretty much right away. You know, obviously, the further you want to go with it, you know, the longer you spend in it, the easier it gets, et cetera. But there's an awful lot that can be done with a pretty basic level of knowledge of what's going on.
So that dude, he wasn't just sitting in the front row playing Farmville. He was actually coding it up.
Yeah. Yeah. He was building it right there in front of me. And I was really impressed. I mean, I'd never seen anybody do that. I've certainly run workshops where people have built stuff, but you know, this was just a regular 90-minute talk. And in that 90 minutes, he, you know, got enough of what am I doing here to build, you know, real simple, here it is, and, you know, got it deployed and running on his phone. So that to me was pretty impressive. Now, granted, he had some technical knowledge. I mean, he knew what an app server was and he had all the deployment pieces and whatnot in place. But, you know, it is remarkable to me just how far you can get, even just with your local browser and a text editor, to be brutally honest with you.
So this jQuery Mobile thing, it's sounding like this is just not a hard thing to pick up. If you're decent at CSS or something, you probably can get it pretty fast, right?
Yeah, that's certainly been my experience.
So given that, what sort of prototypes can I then start to build if I've got just, you know, let's say a day's worth of this stuff under my belt?
I would think you could make some pretty rich prototypes, especially if you've got a little bit of familiarity with kind of the jQuery approach to the world and how that works, if you're comfortable with CSS and kind of their theming concepts. You know, you can build a pretty rich, robust prototype in a shockingly short amount of time. Again, not going to be production-ready code necessarily, you know, may involve just some more static data. You know, you may not be talking to an actual web service or something like that. But, you know, just in terms of getting something out there that you can, you know, show to the decision makers, show to your product owners, you know, run by subject matter expert type people, you know, that's definitely something that can be done, you know, very quickly. I know we actually have a pilot app right now that's using jQuery Mobile and is being very well received in the field. And, you know, from the conversations I've had with the guy that built it, you know, it was very straightforward for him to get this thing up and running. And, you know, it shows different stuff when you change orientation. You know, they change the columns based on orientation, and it's very nice, clean layout. You know, they designed it for the iPad, but you know, it looks really nice and works really well. And from what I've heard, is being quite well received by the field.
So you say it does the orientation change. That's pretty slick. That always gets oohs and ahs from the audience. What other sort of ooh and ah type inspiring things does this app do that they built?
You know, it's pretty simple, all things considered. But I just think the fact that people can actually do this on their iPad and it was done in, you know, a pretty short amount of time is really what got people's attention. It's touch-based, obviously, you know.
It's feeding real data out of something.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's talking to web services. It's production, you know, level stuff, you know, and involves all the security things that go into that and whatnot. And, you know, but it ends up working really well because it solves a problem for the business that they had, and they're delighted to have the solution. And, you know, we're pretty happy that it's working for them. So, you know, we'll see how it progresses. You know, I think the next step for them is what capabilities do you build on top of that, you know, and what else makes sense in that space, you know, because it's pretty clear that mobile is eating the world.
Have you found that getting the real data into a prototype just brings it to like a new level of, oh, I get it?
Yeah, it certainly helps to have realistic data. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to talk to, you know, your dev web services or something like that. But to at least have realistic data, I think, is pretty important. I mean, I've certainly gotten into those conversations doing paper prototyping where it's like, oh, but this isn't realistic. You know, this just says 99999 and that's not, you know, really would be, you know, 1342. It's like, okay, well, just pretend that's the number that's there and let's move on. So, you know, certainly for a lot of folks, they get really caught up in, but this isn't realistic. We don't actually have an account called, you know, Bird Seed Farms. It's like, okay, yep, I know, just suspend your disbelief. So yeah, certainly getting more realistic stuff in there is usually a very good idea.
Years ago, we were doing some prototype testing with fund managers at Fidelity. There's like 45 of these dudes, and they control all of Fidelity's hundreds of trillions of dollars of assets. And we could only work with them like after the market closed, right? We would only get their time for very short periods of time, and we'd put these prototypes in front of them. And I remember once very vividly, we had this prototype that it just had made up data, right? Just had made up data in it, but it had like stock prices. It had like IBM 85 and a half. And I remember the first time that ticker came up and it said IBM 85 and a half, the fund managers just got this sort of stare and just sort of stopped and turned blue and then sort of looked at me and said, that's not the actual price right now, right? I said, no, we just made it up. He says, yeah, okay, good.
Thank goodness, because I just thought we lost $1 billion.
Exactly. And we learned in that minute that we could not have the prices be too far off. So what we would do from that moment on was that right before the session would start, we had this little table and we'd go in and we'd put in the actual prices of whatever it was at that moment. And this was years ago. We had to do it by hand, but we just did it. And then the prototype had the right prices. And suddenly that made everything much better.
It's always interesting what people catch, isn't it? I did a test years and years ago, paper prototype, and it's like my fourth or fifth person that I was testing it on. Like a lot of apps, I had a cancel button. And so the scenario I set up was, okay, let's pretend you're in this account. You've made a few changes and you realize, oh crap, this is the wrong account. I really wanted, you know, bird feed and I'm looking at bird song or whatever. So what would you do? And she just kind of looked at me and she froze. She says, well, I don't think there's anything I can do. And I said, is there any button on here anywhere that you think would maybe take you back to where you came from and get rid of your changes? No, I don't see anything. I said, well, what do you think would happen if you press the cancel button? She said, oh, I'd never press that. I said, really? Why not? She said, well, that would cancel their policy.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Because you're in billing. And if you don't pay your bill after a while, guess what we do? We cancel your account. So yeah, she thought that meant we'd cancel. So I had to rename the button, you know, just like, oops.
We just had a design recently that had a dialogue box for confirming that you wanted to cancel. And the dialogue box said something like, is it okay to cancel this account? And then the two buttons were cancel. Okay,
cancel.
Nice. And the user just sort of stopped and just said, I have no idea what I'm supposed to press here. And I looked at it and said, I have no idea what you're supposed to press there.
I have an entire collection of dialogue boxes that are like that, where it's like, really, what are you asking me to do here? You know, and it's hard, though. I mean, I've done it. It's hard to come up with what that stuff's supposed to be.
You know, that Fidelity IBM thing, it wasn't even the important part of the design. Right? That was the thing. We were not testing whether they could read the stock prices accurately. It was almost like decoration around the thing we were actually interested in, which was this whole flow management system for building institutional investments. And we just had to have something and a price. And that was the problem. We didn't realize until that moment how much that stuff has to be real and it has to be represented in a way that was absolutely critical.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing with what we're talking about here in the mobile space. It's like you can talk about a swipe or a gesture, but are they really going to do that? Are they going to recognize that? Well, let's try it. And for a lot of this stuff, the easiest way to do that is, well, let's get it on a device and see if they figure it out. You know, one of the examples I like to use is, you know, how do you email a tweet? You know, for most Twitter clients, that's a hidden action. And I agree that it should be because, I mean, let's be honest, that's not something most people do. You know, the important things are, can you read a tweet? Can you reply to a tweet? Can you write a tweet? But it's there somewhere. So where do you find it? And it's always interesting to me to talk to people and just sort of say, well, what would you try? You know, and in my experience, there's a percentage of people, and it varies from audience to audience, of folks who get that, oh, yeah, you just do like a long hold or, you know, a triple tap or something like that. But, you know, let's be honest, a lot of folks aren't going to realize that. And how would you sort of bake that into a paper prototype? You know, that gets a lot harder, you know, to do those kind of demos. So it can certainly simplify things to say, okay, I'm going to put you in front of this. This is on an actual physical device. So we remove some of the, you know, suspend your disbelief that this piece of paper is the same size as your iPhone or your iPad. And now tell me, how would you email a tweet and see what they would actually do?
Right. So being able to get those ideas, it's just something simple like, you know, you want the change data to have a yellow background for just a second so that you can tell what it is. How do you test what kind of yellow and how long should that yellow be? And what's the fade?
Right. I mean, so should it be a second? Should it be 2 seconds? Should it be five? Well, let's actually see what it looks like when it's at that length. Go, oh, yeah, that's too long. Ooh, that's not long enough. Oh, that yellow looks really horrible against the rest of our branding. Okay. The easiest way to figure that out is by trying it.
Yep. So, you know, once you got the basic mastery of things like JavaScript and jQuery, this stuff becomes really easy to just bang out and just say, what do you think? How would we do this? What if we did it this way?
Yeah, and it gets us into that iterative mode. You know, so think about what happens when we have these silos between us. So as a designer, you decide this is what you want. You know, you give it to the developer, they go build it and they go test it. Well, now you want to tweak it. So now how long does that take if you have to go through the code gatekeeper, as it were, as opposed to just try it yourself? You want to change the color? Go in here and tweak this value. You want to change how long the fade is? Go tweak this value. You know, it's, again, not rocket science. It's not like you need to have a PhD in computer science to be able to go in and do some of these things. You just need, I think, frankly, the confidence to try it and, you know, a safe environment to try these things in and to understand that, hey, this is actually something I can do. This isn't a black art.
Right. If I want to go off today and really sort of get enough of this JavaScript and jQuery stuff so I can start creating prototypes like this, what should I already know? Do I need to know HTML and CSS? Do I need to know, you know, how to manipulate the DOM? Do I even have to know what a DOM is?
So basic HTML and CSS is, to me, really the prerequisite here to be comfortable in what that HTML structure looks like, to not be frightened by angle brackets and some of the quirkiness that's inherent there. You know, computers don't have as flexible a grammar as we human beings do. They're very literal. So you need to be comfortable dealing with the fact that, you know what, if you don't close this tag, it might not look the way you want it to. And that's just the way the computer is. So just close that out and just accept that that's how things work.
Do I need to understand the dark world of CSS specificity?
Well, I mean, jQuery certainly involves a lot of selectors, you know, so at least being aware and understanding some of the types of questions you can ask, I think, is helpful. You know, I know as a developer type, we often sort of are expected to know these things, but nobody ever wants us to train them in them. You know, nobody ever wants to, like, have a class on how to do this. But when you start showing people that, you know, you can actually ask that question in a more straightforward way if you understand how the CSS selector works. And if you know that you can ask for, like, child and parent and sibling and things like that. And I know I was working with a guy earlier this year. He had this really complicated jQuery selector, and I kind of stared at it for a while. I'm like, man, there's got to be a simpler way, because he was, like, you know, getting a collection back and iterating over it. And it's like, so just a little bit of digging, it's like, oh, yeah, so the structure of your DOM is just like this. So just do, you know, parent, child, I can't remember the exact thing, but, you know, made it much simpler to write, much easier to look at and go, okay, I actually understand what you're trying to do here, as opposed to what was kind of a mess before. So, you know, it helps to have a basic grounding in some of those things. But, you know, to me, the real important criteria is that you understand HTML well enough to know how those tags function, how they work together. CSS helps, obviously, especially understanding the selector side of that game. You know, and just being comfortable working in a text editor and some of those things. You know, there's a lot of different IDEs these days, but I find myself more often than not, maybe it's because I'm old, you know, that I lean back towards, you know, just a good old-fashioned text editor.
Yeah, I mean, the tools for this are pretty straightforward. Well, I'm excited to learn how to do this. I would like to be able to produce these prototypes and make this work.
Yeah, it's not as hard as some people think it is. And maybe I'm not supposed to say that as a developer. Maybe I want to keep some of that mystery there. But, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. I want both camps talking to each other. And, you know, I've spent a lot of years as the developer telling developers about design and why design matters. And, you know, I, for one, am really excited about having an opportunity to talk to the other side of that coin a little more directly to say, hey, guys, you know, what we do isn't that mysterious either. And you are all capable of certainly cranking out a prototype in this stuff. And you should. I mean, that's the other side of it. You know, much like I think developers should dip their quill in a little bit and try to do some design. Again, if for nothing else than an appreciation of what it is our design folks are doing for us and why that's so important. You know, to me, anything we can do to increase collaboration and that understanding of the rest of the team, to me, is just a positive, you know, no matter how we slice it.
This is exciting. I can't wait to get my hands on it. And I'm going to have an opportunity because you're going to be doing a full day workshop on this at the UX Immersion Conference.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's going to be a blast.
So great. So for those of you who are thinking this could be fun, check out Nate's session at the UX Immersion Conference, which he's speaking on April 9th. The whole conference goes from April 7th to 9th. It's in beautiful Denver.
Love Denver.
Yeah, it's going to be a great time. And there's all sorts of great sessions on responsive design and testing. You can take Sid Harrell's session on usability testing and then do Nate's session on creating prototypes to test, and that'll be really great. All of that's going to happen. Give that a look. It's at uxim.co. That's the UX Immersion Mobile Conference, April 7th through 9th in Denver, Colorado. Nate, thank you so much for taking the time today to demystify this stuff for us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
And I want to thank our audience once again for taking the time and spending it with us. Hey, if you're not subscribed to our newsletter, UIE Tips, where we publish stuff just like this on a regular basis, you might want to check that out. It's uie.com/UIE Tips. Just put in your email address and you'll get on the list. And of course, all sorts of good UX stuff there all the time. And you can unsubscribe at any time as soon as you get bored with it. And that's okay. We're cool with that. Thank you for taking the time to listen. And once again, thank you very much for encouraging our behavior. We'll talk to you next time. Take care.
Visit uximco. That's uximco. As always, thank you for listening.